It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get the latest in national politics with our friend Paul Singer from USA Today.
First, in a speech last week to the Rotary Club in Madison, Milwaukee Bucks president Peter Fagan called Milwaukee the most racist, segregated place he's ever experienced. Yesterday, Fagan softened those comments, calling Milwaukee a terrific community and saying he didn't intend to characterize the general community as racist.
There's been a lot of reaction to those comments since they came out. James Causey joins us now to talk about the comments and issues of race and segregation in Milwaukee. He's a columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you.
What was your initial reaction when you heard that Milwaukee Bucks president Peter Fagan said Milwaukee is one of the most segregated and racist places he's ever experienced?
Well, honestly, I wasn't really shocked by that. I think that's a sentiment that's felt by a lot of people in Milwaukee who don't feel that they're getting their fair shake in the economic and from an economic standpoint.
And let's break down the two parts of that, segregated and racist. Segregated, I mean, there's a lot of data on that. The numbers are out there. Milwaukee and the area are a very heavily segregated community, aren't they?
Right, and that's the part that's really interesting. People don't want to... They give you the segregation part. They won't even argue that. They say, yeah, Milwaukee is segregated. If you look anywhere in Milwaukee, if you're black, you probably live on the north side. If you're Hispanic, you probably live, on the south side. And, you know, so it's very, very segregated, hyper-segregated in Milwaukee. And I would even go to say that you can almost tell by a person's race where they live, you know, within blocks of where they live. So that hasn't changed, and no one tends to argue that part. The racist part is the part that seems to have everyone up in arms. And he's speaking from his personal experience. And I don't know why we want to argue against what he sees personally. I think what we should be asking is, compared to where else have you lived, and what can we do to get better?
Right. Do you see the reaction to his statements as, hey, yeah, let's have a conversation about segregation, racism in Milwaukee, or, hey, why is this out-of-town businessman, we're paying lots of money to help build a stadium, criticizing our city?
It's more of the latter. I mean, I've been flooded with emails today with people telling me to go after him and telling him that he needs to get the money back then if he feels this way, and why would a business leader or the president of the Bucks want to build a stadium here or a new arena here if he feels that way. The best part about what he said is that he wants to be a part of the solution, and he believes that the team could be a part of the solution, and I would like to hear what those plans are. Right now, we don't seem to have a plan in place to address segregation or hyper-segregation or racism in this city. Our business leaders don't speak out on it. Our political leaders really don't speak out on it. And so people are left to just deal with it on their own, and nothing has been resolved. As a matter of fact, it's gotten worse. And usually when you have unrest in a city like we had in Sherman Park, segregation, racism, and all those things come to their show the ugly head, and that's when we want to have that discussion.
Well, James, I'll tell you, I broke one of my rules today, and I read the comments on a lot of articles covering these comments and the issues that they raised. And honestly, it's one of those cases where you could, you know, maybe the comments are being written by people in two different countries. People arguing segregation is here, but, oh, it just kind of happens naturally by personal choice versus segregation, real thing, real problem. And then racism, yes, daily reality, or racism, no, not here at all. I mean, how do you start to solve a problem when there's such massive polarization on the existence of the problem?
Well, I mean, think about it. How many poor people want to live next to poor people? I mean, I don't know people who make that as a choice, that that's what they want to do. People live where they're kind of forced to live. And you know, if they had money, if they had means of transportation, if they had other ways to live in these different places, they would do so. You know, we have one of the largest educational gaps in this country here in Wisconsin, and we have one of the largest economic gaps as well. We have a lot of poverty here. And due to that poverty, people are forced to live in areas where they probably, that these areas need a lot of police assistance to help them deal with a lot of issues that they face with crime. And that's not fair to anyone. And, you know, the part I really have a problem with is when it comes to segregation is people feel that, yeah, we may need the bodies of people to work out at these different places, like work at the Walmarts and work at these different locations. So when they build these big facilities, but they don't want people to live out there. You know, we had these issues before, and they showed this ugly head when workers say, well, you know, we're working out in these places, and we would like to live closer to these places because it's harder for us to get transportation out here. And people say, no, you know, you go back to where you were, but you could come out here and work, and that's just not fair. Now, how did we get here is a question. How did we get to a place where we're so hyper-segregated? That's the golden question. And another thing with racism, I mean, if anybody thinks racism is over or is done because we had a black president, then they're mistaken. I think and racism doesn't have to be, I'm sorry I'm talking about a lot of different things, but
that's
racism
fine.
Doesn't necessarily have to be that it's white people are racist against blacks. There are some blacks that are racist against whites as well. So we just really have to come to the table and start having a discussion about our differences and work those things out, because deep down inside, I think we all want the same things. We want our families to live in safe neighborhoods. We want our kids to go to great schools and receive great educations. And we want to be able to live the American dream. And unfortunately, too many of us are not.
Talking to James Causey from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about recent comments from the president of the Milwaukee Bucks describing Milwaukee as racist and segregated. He's walked those back a little, but not completely. A lot of conversations happened since then. And James, let's talk more about the conversation. You said you wanted to see more leadership, more people in positions like Peter Fagan's bringing these issues up. Who else would you like to see leadership from, people trying to take these issues head on?
Well, I think that would be a great bully pulpit for our governor, and will be a great one for our mayor of this city. These are issues that where we really have to bring all people together and have these discussions. I mean, instead of just having them in our silos. I was having this discussion with one of my colleagues today, and the question came up about Fagan, and I posed a question to him. I said, well, when you really think about it, how many people do you have that are your true friends, that are within your circle, that are outside your race? And, you know, it was one of those kind of conversations where he really had to think about it. I mean, really true friends that are not your race, but your true friends that are in your circle. And there's been studies on this, and a lot of us don't really have a lot of people outside of work. And I'm not talking about people you work with. I'm talking about true friends who don't look like you or who are not of your same race, who are your true friends. And that's a problem. That's a real problem, because we know diversity matters, and we know that it matters in our workplaces, it matters in our neighborhoods, it matters in trying to get things and goals accomplished, that we all need each other, but we can't seem to get over that hurdle. And that's where we need to have real leadership come to the forefront and talk about these issues. Now, when it comes to unemployment and all these other things that come up, I think a lot of people want to put, you know, racism and segregation on a back burner, but maybe that's part of the problem, that these issues have been put on the back burner for so long and never discussed, that we have no way of really having any discussions without getting mad at each other and criticizing each other. And that needs to change.
And James, I want to end by asking you an unfairly huge question that I think a lot of people are trying to solve, but I'll ask you anyway. You know, that what you're saying about us not having friends of different races than ourselves, how do you convene that? How do you make that start happening, especially in a community as segregated as Milwaukee or many other parts of Wisconsin, for that matter?
That's a good question. I wrote a column about this maybe a year or so ago when something happened. I don't remember what the incident was, but I wrote a column. I said, well, it starts by doing something really simple. Invite somebody out to eat who doesn't look like you, and having just a frank discussion about issues. And it doesn't necessarily have to be about race, but just having a discussion about issues. And you'll see how much more you probably have in common than you have not in common. It just starts with us reaching out to each other. And I encourage everyone to do it. And one of my bosses did that with me. And it was eye-opening for both of us. And we all could be better at it. It's funny because when we're kids, we make friends so easy. We don't care about the race of the person. We don't care if they're rich or poor or anything like that. But as we get older, it becomes harder to do. And we need to start breaking down those walls and just say, hey, let's just do lunch. Let's grab a cup of Joe. Let's just talk. It starts with a conversation, and it starts on a small level.
And we'll have more conversations with you in the future. James, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, no problem.
That was James Causey, columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked to us about comments from Milwaukee Bucks president Peter Fagan on racism and segregation in Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, there have been claims that private property rights on Native American reservations will help alleviate poverty. Our guest tells us why she thinks that's not the most effective policy.
Right now, we've made it past the first presidential debate, and the candidates are hitting the campaign trail to make their case in key battleground states.
Also, a new report shows shifting religious affiliations in the electorate, and that may affect voter preferences in coming elections. And a prominent newspaper broke with convention in their presidential endorsement.
Joining us now to talk about the latest from the campaign trail is Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Well, what was your main takeaway from the debate earlier this week?
Honestly, my main takeaway from the debate is that Donald Trump can still be riled. He takes this stuff personally. It was really interesting to hear him say basically that Hillary Clinton was running a bunch of negative ads against him, and that's not nice, and he doesn't deserve it. It was just an odd revelation that his feelings get hurt, which from a guy who is known to be kind of a bare-knuckle brawler. I mean, this is his style, is to be aggressive and lying Ted and cheating Hillary. It's just really interesting to hear him say, hey, you hurt my feelings. It really struck me that he could basically take offense.
In terms of the points made by both Trump and Clinton that were made during the course of the debate, which ones do you think are going to prove the stickiest, that are going to stay with those candidates for better or worse for the next few news cycles?
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, the sad part is I think that, on a policy basis, Donald Trump's best moment sort of got lost in this whole thing. I mean, Trump managed to corner Hillary Clinton on trade. And gave her with no really good answer. She provided no really good answer on where do you stand on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I don't think he handled it properly, but he really had her at sort of against the ropes there and saying, well, okay, is it Obama's fault that the agreement's no good? But that issue got lost under all of this stuff about, is Miss Universe actually Miss Piggy? And that stuff is just unfortunately takes over. I mean, I think ultimately, the real takeaway from the debate is that Donald Trump didn't have 90 minutes worth of material at his fingertips. He had 20 minutes or half an hour worth of material at his fingertips, and then he got stuck. And when you sort of let him get off on this kind of ad-libbing, he doesn't really have a lot of material prepared, or didn't have a lot of material prepared. And I think that cost him. He didn't manage to bring up things that were bad for Hillary Clinton, like her foundation or like her emails, and really press her on it. He didn't have the facts on his fingers.
The polls had been getting closer and closer. Hillary Clinton's lead had been slipping leading up to this debate. We're still just 2 days out. Not a whole ton of polling can happen in that time. Are you seeing any early indications, or what are you watching for to see if this debate actually made a difference among voters?
I'm actually going to ignore everything for another day or two. I believe that sort of the voter population at large has a consciousness that moves, but it takes a few days to bake in. So I suspect by the end of this week we'll have some first polls coming out of the debates. I mean, the conversation has been generally favorable to Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump has been on the defensive about his performance. So that would indicate that even he and his campaign sense that it wasn't his best night. But then again, I also am not convinced there's a whole lot of undecided voters to sway here. I think we're really at the point where the question is, are you driving your people to the polls?
And given what we saw on Monday night, Paul, what are you expecting to see, if any, change in approach when it comes to either candidate for the next two debates coming up?
Well, I think that, you know, my impression is that Trump and his staff are going to try and basically practice a little more material, practice a little more. And this is a politician thing. If you've ever spent any time around politicians, you'll notice they have this incredible skill of answering the question they wanted you to ask, not the question you actually asked, and changing the conversation to the topic they want to discuss. And it's something that it takes practice to do because it's not natural. Most of us, if you ask a question, you get an answer that's related to the question. What Donald Trump has not been able to yet master is the art of changing the topic, changing the premise of the conversation to a subject that he'd rather talk about. And I think it's something they're probably going to practice. How do you pivot from, you know, what Hillary Clinton did? When they said, how about your emails? He said, oh, yeah, well, how about his tax returns? Right? I mean, that's the thing that a politician learns to do, and I suspect he'll practice some of that.
Before we move on from the debate, Paul, there's a lot of people watch this thing, 80 million plus, then people who listen to it as well. A lot of times I think a big event like this, a lot of people just get it the next day in clips and sound bites and newspaper analysis. This was unmediated in a way. People watch this thing directly. Does that matter?
I don't know. I mean, again, it's a question of how much. I mean, yeah, it does, because people see the initial reaction to how they watch these people interact. The problem is, what I don't know, Rob, is how many people sit there and watch an hour and a half of it. You know, do you tune out? Are you really watching the debate? Or are you watching the Twitter reaction to the debate? Are you watching the what your friends email you about the debate? I just don't know the answer to that question. It's been a long time since I was an uninterested observer sitting in my house with a bowl of popcorn and a beer, which is how I used to watch the debates. And I don't really know if people do that anymore. I think there are so many distractions and so many second screen experiences that part of it is you're sort of absorbing the commentary as well as the live stream simultaneously.
We're talking with Paul Singer from USA Today, talking about the latest in national politics. And, Paul, you wrote a piece recently about the increasing number of people who self-identify as being unaffiliated. They're often called the nuns when it comes to their religion. And that seems to be a break from previous generations. How might this shake out at the polls?
It's very hard to tell. They're a really interesting group, and these studies have all been going the same way, that basically the number of people who will tell you they are affiliated with a certain religion is dropping dramatically, and really dropping dramatically amongst millennials. I believe the number was like 39% of millennials said they are not affiliated with any particular religion. And when I say that, I mean a pollster gets them on the phone and says, well, you know, are you Christian? Are you Jewish? Are you Catholic? Are you Protestant? Are you Muslim? Are you Hindu? And the person has to answer, no, I'm none of those things. So it's not only saying, do you go to church regularly or anything else? It's saying, no, I'm not actually, I don't consider myself a member of a faith group. 39% of the millennial generation, that's a huge number of people and a significant, could be a significant voting block. The problem the reason that they're not necessarily decisive in the elections, they don't vote very often. Some of the numbers we saw is that while evangelicals are about, you know, maybe the same number of the population, about 20% of the voting population, they end up being 26% of the vote because they actually show up in droves, whereas these millennials end up being, maybe 12, 13% of the vote. So if you could ever engage them in a conversation that drives them to the polls, they could be a very powerful force. But here's the question. Where do you find them? Since they're not religiously affiliated, they're not the same place on Sundays where you can go get them. So it's a really interesting question, and I think something that'll be very interesting to watch as they grow older. They're more likely to engage in voting behavior, regular voting behavior, and then suddenly you can ask the question, what if our voting population becomes predominantly non-religious? Would that change how we vote? Very interesting.
And how would it change how, say, a political party or a candidate tries to reach voters? I imagine they're probably going to wrestle with this issue in the years to come.
I think they will. And the study that I was looking at suggested that a lot of these people have left the church because of basically they find the church, or they have left various churches, not just the church, you know, pick a church. They've left faith communities because, in part, they felt the faith communities were too conservative on a bunch of issues, most notably climate change and gay marriage. So in theory, those would be Democratic issues, that these might be Democratic voters in the future. But I think it's a great question of where do how do the politicians reach that community that is not, at the moment, actively voting, and what do you connect them to? If you say, I mean, you're not going to say to them, well, you know, I care about the same faith issues you care about. No, no, no. You have to get to them with, I care about the same social issues that you care about that motivate you. So where do you find those people, how you engage them, I think is a really interesting question for, you know, the election of 2020 or the election of 2024.
So you don't expect it to come into play in this election?
I don't expect it to come into play in this election, again, because I don't think, well, two reasons. One is I don't think that this group is going to be a big enough voting bloc again to really make the difference. They were very enthusiastic about Barack Obama. They are not, I don't think, as enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. We've seen that over and over again. And second of all, this election has been less about issues like that. I mean, once upon a time, there were a lot of state-based initiatives to, like, ban gay marriage or limit abortion that would drive both sides to the polls. You don't see a lot of those on the ballots around the country this year. Those are not the issues that are driving people to the polls. I do think that Jill Stein and the Green Party, and to some degree Hillary Clinton, are trying to capture climate change to drive people to the polls. But I honestly just don't know yet whether it's reaching these voters.
Paul, a one-question lightning round. Another newspaper that traditionally endorses Republicans going back a long time now, the Arizona Republic, and now has endorsed Hillary Clinton. Does that matter? What do you make of that briefly?
I never think that the newspaper endorsements matter. What it does matter is it offers cover in this election for sort of centrist or traditional Republicans who want an excuse to not vote for Donald Trump and possibly vote for Hillary Clinton. These kind of endorsements from traditional Republican outlets give them the cover they need to say, I'm not selling out my party when I don't vote for Donald Trump.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. You be well.
You too. That's Paul Singer. He joined us to talk about the latest in national politics. Paul is the Washington correspondent for USA Today.
Coming up after the news, a guest tells us why she believes private land ownership isn't the solution for socioeconomic challenges facing Native American reservations. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we hear about Senator Ron Johnson's Right to Try bill, which would give terminally ill patients more access to experimental drugs that haven't gotten FDA approval.
First, from the arrival of early European settlers to the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, conflicts over Native American lands have been a big part of American history. Last month, we talked to Naomi Schaefer Riley, author of the book The New Trail of Tears. She argued that reservations see high rates of poverty and suicide because of current federal policy on land ownership. The main problem with that policy, she argued, was that it didn't allow for private land ownership.
We heard from callers and listeners after that in Wisconsin, including some of the state's own Native American communities, who felt that the conversation needed another perspective. Our next guest recently wrote a piece for The Atlantic called Private Land Ownership Won't Solve Native American Poverty. That article's posted on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Kelly Mosteller. She's director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center and a tribal historic preservation officer based in Oklahoma. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And you say there's kind of a fundamental difference in some ways between the ways a lot of American culture thinks of land and the way Native American communities often do. You say in your article that for most Americans, land is money. How does that run counter to how a lot of tribal cultures view land?
Well, I think that the argument there is that it's not a simple link between land ownership equaling success and money. And I'm also not trying to argue that for Native Americans that we don't understand the importance of land for financial and economic gain. But in our case, we do have historic either ancestral ties to this land, or it is the source of our land base that allows us to have sovereignty and authority and dictate how our communities are managed and run. So, you know, for Native Americans, the land is not just, you know, that piece of property which we can buy and sell and exploit for financial gain. It has that cultural element, and it is the literal foundation of our tribal sovereignty and of our nations.
I want to listen to a little bit of our previous guest, Naomi Schaefer Riley, talking some about federal land policies and reservations.
Okay. Now, actually, the policies are preventing Native Americans from exercising economic freedom. And what I mean by that is that Native Americans don't actually own reservation land. The fact that it's held in trust by the federal government means that they can't buy it and sell it among themselves without the approval of a staff member at the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington. It means that if an American Indian wanted to go to the bank and get a mortgage to purchase a house, he could not do that because the bank would say you don't have the underlying title to the land.
So what's your reaction to that and the rest of her argument for that matter?
Well, that statement has a lot of issues packed into it, and I feel like she glosses over that. The first thing is that there are 560-plus tribes in the United States, and each of them has their own circumstances. I know you did get around to that eventually in the previous interview, but even the statement that Native Americans don't own their land, there are a lot of different land statuses for Native Americans. Individual tribal members can own land both in trust and in fee, which is essentially own it privately with some restrictions. And then tribes can also own land in trust or in fee, or fee land without restrictions on it. So essentially like any other group would own land. So that argument has not even been made within her Atlantic article or the interview that I heard with you. She's really talking about strictly reservation land. And that's very different for a tribe that lives on a reservation than tribes like my own and all of the tribes in Oklahoma. We do not have true reservations in Oklahoma, and we have 39 tribes here. What we have is jurisdiction. Tribal lands are held in trust in a checkerboard pattern often because we purchase back lands that have been moved out of tribal hands, and we're purchasing them back as a tribe, but we own it first in fee, and then we go through the process to put it into trust so that it becomes part of our jurisdiction and our base of our authority for our tribal government. So even the argument that all land is reservation land and that it has this one distinct status, that oversimplifies the issue. Also, the current policy, as she states, is that the federal government owns the land and has the title to the land and holds it in trust for the tribes. And I don't have the exact quote, but I do believe that she mentioned something that you only hold things in trust for children or for those who are mentally incapable of caring for it for themselves. The status of trust land for Native American tribes is a little bit different than that. It's actually the trust relationship between the tribes and the federal government also means that the tribes have the guarantee of that the federal government should uphold their federal trust responsibility. So it's a two-way street. You know, it does put some restrictions on what the tribe can do with the land as far as selling it and things like that, but it also means that the federal government has an obligation to uphold the laws and the treaties and all of the pieces of legislation that protect that land from being taxed by local municipalities or encroached upon by landowners or corporations. And it provides some of the protections that Native Americans have experienced with a tax on their lands for more than two centuries.
We're talking to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center. She's based in Oklahoma, talking about Native Americans and property ownership in the United States. And Kelly, our guest, Naomi Schaefer Riley, had talked about difficult conditions facing some Native Americans in some communities, poverty, suicide rates, things like that. She tried to draw a direct line between the current state of property ownership and said, don't keep looking to history or historic injustice to explain these problems. You say we need to pay attention to the history of American treatment of Native Americans and land ownership in particular. Can you spell that out a little?
Absolutely. You can't look at a people whose legal rights and legal foundations are built on 200-plus years of failed policies and the legislation that results from them, and it, to disregard the decades and decades of work that tribes have put into pushing for the honoring of treaties and for distancing ourselves from any kind of incursions by the federal government or other than individuals that would bring back policies like allotment, which is essentially what Naomi Schaefer Riley is pushing for. It's just repackaged in a 21st century format for, you know, free market audience. What we're trying to say is that to say that you have to disregard the history and only look at the current policy is naive of the fact that these policies that are impacting us today are built on those foundations. It is built on 200 years of colonialism and people being moved off of their land for the sake of taking it into private hands and exploiting it for non-Native communities. It looks at our residential schools and children being taken away from their families and that impact that it has on them and the hurt and the pain and the historic trauma that has been passed down through communities that does have a direct impact on the very statistics that she was mentioning, the suicide rates, the alcohol rates, and things like that. Also, she is very much cherry-picking the communities that have some of the worst social conditions in the country. You know, I could very easily go through and if I was wanting to do the same thing for the United States at large and choose cities that have certain social conditions that are more challenging than others, but to then come behind and suggest a sweeping policy that applies to all of them would be to disregard those unique circumstances of each community have their historic base, and that's essentially what she's doing. Tribes each have a historic base that has made these conditions present in their community.
One thing you recommend in your piece in The Atlantic that would maybe be aimed at the unique nature of all the different communities, you're looking for more sovereignty from recognized by the federal government, more autonomy from the federal government, I gather, so that communities could make their own decisions more tailored to their own situations. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Each of these communities, as I mentioned, has their own history. So any time the federal government has tried to dictate from Washington a single unified Indian policy that applies to everyone, it has been a complete disaster and has been incredibly destructive to Native communities culturally, economically, socially. All of these elements have played out for the near destruction of many tribes. The only way we are going to see social and economic advancement in Native communities is to pull back and allow those tribes to decide what is needed in their community, whether it is more health care services, whether it is housing for elders, schools, whatever it may be. The federal government has the obligation to carry out the treaties and the various compacts that they've signed with these tribes. But it doesn't mean that they should have to dictate where every single dollar goes if it doesn't make sense for that community. It must, all of the changes that are going to bring about beneficial social and economic advancement for Native American tribes are going to be rooted within the tribes themselves. Let them decide what they need for their own communities.
We're talking to Kelly Mosteller. She's director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center and a tribal historic preservation officer. She says a sweeping change, one of her previous guests had called for, to private land ownership across the board is not the best solution for economic problems facing Native American communities.
And we want to hear from you on this. Tell us where you stand on private land ownership for Native American reservations. Do you think it would help or that the benefits are overstated? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a member of a tribe, tell us how you view land and what it means to you and your community. And tell us what you think the federal government's role on reservations should be. Again, that number, 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up the conversation with Kelly Mosteller. She says private land ownership is not the solution to poverty in Native American communities. We heard the argument for private land ownership on reservations in particular last month from Naomi Schaefer Riley, author of the book The New Trail of Tears.
And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page. If you're a member of a tribe, we want to hear how you feel in particular. Tell us what you think the federal government's role should be on reservations, especially as controversy around the Dakota Access Pipeline continues. Our number is 800-642-1234.
And Kelly, I want to go back to that previous interview we mentioned, the guest making the case that modern issues of stereotyping, not a big part of the problem. I'm going to give a little listen here to her talking about the Native American mascot issue.
I went to a variety of Indian communities across the country, and I was hard-pressed to find somebody who thought about changing team names or mascots as a priority in addressing the needs of their community. And as you can see from a recent Washington Post poll that suggested that 9 out of 10, or more than 9 out of 10, American Indians said they didn't really care about the name Redskins for the Washington football team.
So, Kelly, how do you think these issues about mascots and symbols fit into the larger conversation?
I think that symbols have power and words have power. The first issue that I have with her statement is the citing of the Washington Post poll. That is an incredibly problematic poll. It allowed for people who self-identify as Native American to comment as though they were tribal members, and that would include anyone who, you know, their family history tells that there was a Native American person somewhere in the past. You know, they could claim to be Native American. If you poll people who are enrolled members of federally recognized tribes, those numbers are much stronger to show that this is an issue. And there has been a lot of work done around this in recent years, and there are studies that have been conducted that shows that it does impact young Native Americans, especially those in elementary school. It affects their self-esteem and the way they see themselves and the way their classmates see them. One of the phrases that I heard Naomi Schaefer Riley use was that it is absurd and offensive to focus energies on issues like the mascot issue when there are so many other social problems. And to use the words absurd and offensive for the efforts of a Native community that they themselves have decided this is important for their community is exactly what I was discussing earlier. It is about not understanding sovereignty. The Oneida Nation, for example, has chosen to make the mascot issue a priority for them, and they have actually launched the website changethemascot.org. Each of these communities has the right to set what is a priority for them, and so to be disparaging of that by saying it's absurd and offensive is inappropriate. It's highly inappropriate. And I can say that as a Native American who works in a Native community with Native youth, it does affect them. A high school very close to us has the mascot of the Savages, and many of the students I've worked with attend that school, and they talk to me about how it made them feel to have that name and that mascot around them every day, and to go to pep rallies and see effigies of Native Americans being, drug behind cars and things like that. It happens every year around football season. And I had a young student who actually, in her graduation announcement, she, at the very top of it, said, on her graduation announcement, "I'm not a savage, I'm Muskogee." It takes away the individual identity. And as I said earlier, words have power. It really does matter. And I've heard it firsthand from students who say that it does.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Aaron, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just like to make a comment about that last comment. Wow, yes, mascots should be abolished. I went to high school, Mount Mohawks, and now it's the West Tonka Wildcats, and I'm very glad that they did change that. But my reason for calling was a comment about if they make all tribal lands private, then that would open up the possibility of a very wealthy land developer or oil company to come in and purchase that land, and then there would be no more reservations.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Kelly?
I completely agree. It opens up to land speculation. When land is held privately, it opens up the possibility for the claim of eminent domain. Private land ownership does not have the same protections that trust land has. Also, the tribes do not have the authority to speak as a sovereign nation on privately held land. So, for example, with the Dakota Access Pipeline, I've heard some arguments made that, well, if the tribe had owned that land privately, they could have stopped the pipeline. And I think that's a naive description of the situation. There are a lot of ways that private lands are taken from private citizens every day, but it is much more difficult if the tribe has trust status on that land. They are seen as the sovereign governing body over that land, and their tribal historic preservation officer, of which I am for my tribe, has a lot more authority on the projects that take place on that land.
Aaron, thanks for that call. We're talking to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center, talking about land ownership, Native Americans, and federal law and federal treaties. We'll go next to Lucille in Luxembourg from Oklahoma, I understand. Lucille, hi.
Hi. I don't think they should let the land go to private owners. It's my opinion. I think that the Indians should have their own land, and they should take care of it, and the private people should stay away from it. But I also want to know is my husband's mother put on her birth certificate she was white. How does he go around? How does he go about finding out his heritage?
So wait, do you think she was Cherokee. Actually Native American, Lucille?
Yes, he was. He's Cherokee. He's part Cherokee.
All right, Lucille.
His grandmother was a medicine woman in the tribe.
Lucille, thanks for that call. I don't know if you want to address that briefly, Kelly, if there's a way to track tribal heritage.
Actually, if she does have a inclination as to what tribe he would have been a member of, you can reach out to that tribe's tribal enrollment department, and each tribe has their own qualifications for how to get on their rolls. So that is dictated by each sovereign tribe.
All right. Lucille, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Matthew in Baraboo. Matthew, hi.
Hi. I'm actually taking cultural diversity class right now. We are actually covering this very subject right now. And we're in the subject right now where they had actually abolished the private land ownership from the Native American. And I was just wondering, why would we be bringing up the subject of trying to make it private once again? We originally disregarded all our responsibilities federally and allowed the tribes to take over their own land, reservation land.
Matthew, bad signal, but I think we get the gist. And Kelly, you've written and said that you're kind of surprised that we're bringing back kind of a 19th century idea that you say has already failed.
Absolutely. This is essentially the same principle as allotment, which was a policy that was implemented in the late 19th century. Different tribes had to undergo the allotment process at different times, but it essentially took commonly held land and surveyed it out and broke it into different parcels, and each tribal member was to select a parcel and eventually get the title to that land and to become private landowners, with the end result in claiming to be that they would become assimilated farmers and prosper. What happened almost every single case is that the land was taxed, or that there would be a crop failure and someone wouldn't be able to pay taxes, or that, as the first caller mentioned, land speculators would come through and undercut an individual or outright steal land that wasn't being occupied at that time and just be a squatter. And all of a sudden, there's all kinds of legal questions about who owns the land. So We have seen this policy implemented before under another name.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Kelly Mosteller, director of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Cultural Heritage Center. She's a tribal historic preservation officer. We've been talking about Native Americans, land ownership, and federal law. Last month, we talked to a guest who said we need more private land ownership. Kelly made the case against it today.
There's a fun hashtag trending on Twitter this afternoon with all the fanfare over the pumpkin spice latte or the PSL. The National Lampoon seems to have asked Twitter users for their best rejected fall drinks.
So these are things like the pumpkin spice latte, but that are less appetizing. So here's a sampling. Gourd spiced root beer.
Yum.
I don't know what a gourd would taste like. It's not really intended for consumption. Turkey cran gravy. Good so far. Milkshake.
Yeah,
not so good. Not so good.
And here's one that sounds even worse, if possible. Raked leaf mocha latte.
You really taste the autumn in that.
This one, I think one of our former producers, sometime producer Chris Molina, would like. The candy corn juice.
Yeah, he likes any weird candy flavor. Old spice latte. No.
Warm pumpkin spice milk. That one doesn't sound bad. Kind of like a steamer,
warm,
like an almond steamer.
Okay, I could see that. Pumpkin spice apple cider eggnog. That doesn't actually, that could work.
Pumpkin spice,
I mean, I don't
apple
do the cinnamon,
cider
but,
eggnog. Yeah. It could be something there. An organic pumpkin and kale cappuccino.
And I came up with a, you know, you get the celeriac this time of year, a celeriac milkshake.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty horrible.
Although a milkshake, ice cream, and milk can mask a lot.
All right. Trying great flavors so you don't have to. This is Central Time.